Robert, with all his faults, was so true to his word, that when he first heard of this nobleman having risen against his brother, he laid waste the Earl of Shrewsbury at EMS estates in Normandy, to show the king that he would favour no breach of their treaty. Finding, on better information, afterwards, that the Earl at EMS only crime was having been his friend, he came over to England, in his old thoughtless, warm-hearted way, to intercede with the king, and remind him of the solemn promise to pardon all his followers. This confidence might have put the false king to the blush, but it did not. Pretending to be very friendly, he so surrounded his brother with spies and traps, that Robert, who was quite in his power, had nothing for it but to renounce his pension and escape while he could. Getting home to Normandy, and understanding the king better now, he naturally allied himself with his old friend the Earl of Shrewsbury, who had still 30 castles in that country. This was exactly what Henry wanted. He immediately declared that Robert had broken the treaty, and next year invaded Normandy. He pretended that he came to deliver the Normans, at their own request, from his brother at EMS misrule. There is reason to fear that his misrule was bad enough, for his beautiful wife had died, leaving him with an infant son, and his court was again so careless, dissipated, and ill-regulated, that it was said he sometimes lay in bed of a day for want of clothes to put on, his attendants having stolen all his dresses. But he headed his army like a brave prince and a gallant soldier, though he had the misfortune to be taken prisoner by King Henry, with 400 of his knights. Among them was poor harmless Edgar Atheling, who loved Robert well. Edgar was not important enough to be severe with. The king afterwards gave him a small pension, which he lived upon and died upon, in peace, among the quiet woods and fields of England. And Roberta, poor, kind, generous, wasteful, heedless Robert, with so many faults, and yet with virtues that might have made a better and a happier man, what was the end of him? If the king had had the magnanimity to say with a kind air, "Eh, brother, tell me, before these noblemen, that from this time you will be my faithful follower and friend, and never raise your hand against me or my forces more," A.T.M. he might have trusted Robert to the death. But the king was not a magnanimous man. He sentenced his brother to be confined for life in one of the royal castles. In the beginning of his imprisonment, he was allowed to ride out, guarded, but he one day broke away from his guard and galloped off. He had the evil fortune to ride into a swamp, where his horse stuck fast and he was taken. When the king heard of it, he ordered him to be blinded, which was done by putting a red-hot metal basin on his eyes. And so, in darkness and in prison, many years, he thought of all his past life, of the time he had wasted, of the treasure he had squandered, of the opportunities he had lost, of the youth he had thrown away, of the talents he had neglected. Sometimes, on fine autumn mornings, he would sit and think of the old hunting parties in the free forest, where he had been the foremost and the gayest. Sometimes, in the still nights, he would wake, and mourn for the many knights that had stolen past him at the gaming table. Sometimes, would seem to hear, upon the melancholy wind, the old songs of the minstrels. Sometimes, would dream, in his blindness, of the light and glitter of the Norman court. Many and many a time, he groped back, in his fancy, to Jerusalem, where he had fought so well, or, at the head of his brave companions, bowed his feathered helmet to the shouts of welcome greeting him in Italy, and seemed again to walk among the sunny vineyards, or on the shore of the blue sea, with his lovely wife. And then, thinking of her grave, and of his fatherless boy, he would stretch out his solitary arms and weep. At length, one day, there lay in prison, dead, with cruel and disfiguring scars upon his eyelids, bandaged from his jailer at EMS site, but on which the eternal heavens looked down, a worn old man of 80. He had once been Robert of Normandy. Pity him. At the time when Robert of Normandy was taken prisoner by his brother, Robert at EMS' little son was only 5 years old. This child was taken, too, and carried before the king, sobbing and crying, for, young as he was, he knew he had good reason to be afraid of his royal uncle. The king was not much accustomed to pity those who were in his power, but his cold heart seemed for the moment to soften towards the boy. He was observed to make a great effort, as if to prevent himself from being cruel, and ordered the child to be taken away, whereupon a certain baron, who had married a daughter of Duke Roberta TMS, by name, Helie of Saint-Sin, took charge of him, tenderly. The king of TMS gentleness did not last long. Before 2 years were over, he sent messengers to this lord at TMS castle to seize the child and bring him away. The baron was not there at the time, but his servants were faithful, and carried the boy off in his sleep and hid him. When the baron came home, and was told what the king had done, he took the child abroad, and, leading him by the hand, went from king to king and from court to court, relating how the child had a claim to the throne of England, and how his uncle the king, knowing that he had that claim, would have murdered him, perhaps, but for his escape. The youth and innocence of the pretty little William Fitzrobert, for that was his name, made him many friends at that time. When he became a young man, the King of France, uniting with the French Counts of Anjou and Flanders, supported his cause against the King of England, and took many of the King of TMS towns and castles in Normandy. But, King Henry, artful and cunning always, bribed some of William's TMS friends with money, some with promises, some with power. He bought off the Count of Anjou, by promising to marry his eldest son, also named William, to the Count of TMS daughter. And indeed the whole trust of this king of TMS life was in such bargains, and he believed, as many another king has done since, and as one king did in France a very little time ago, that every man of TMS truth and honor can be bought at some price. For all this, he was so afraid of William Fitzrobert and his friends, that, for a long time, he believed his life to be in danger, and never lay down to sleep, even in his palace surrounded by his guards, without having a sword and buckler at his bedside. To strengthen his power, the king with great ceremony betrothed his eldest daughter Matilda, then a child only 8 years old, to be the wife of Henry V, the Emperor of Germany. To raise her marriage portion, he taxed the English people in a most oppressive manner, then treated them to a great procession, to restore their good humor, and sent Matilda away, in fine state, with the German ambassadors, to be educated in the country of her future husband. And now his queen, Maud the Good, unhappily died. It was a sad thought for that gentle lady, that the only hope with which she had married a man whom she had never loved, either the hope of reconciling the Norman and English race, had failed. At the very time of her death, Normandy and all France was in arms against England, for, so soon as his last danger was over, King Henry had been false to all the French powers he had promised, bribed, and bought, and they had naturally united against him. After some fighting, however, in which few suffered but the unhappy common people, who always suffered, whatsoever was the matter, he began to promise, bribe, and buy again, and by those means, and by the help of the Pope, who exerted himself to save more bloodshed, and by solemnly declaring, over and over again, that he really was in earnest this time, and would keep his word, the king made peace. No one admired this king of TMS renown for bravery more than Saladin himself, who was a generous and gallant enemy. When Richard lay ill of a fever, Saladin sent him fresh fruits from Damascus, and snow from the mountain tops. Courtly messages and compliments were frequently exchanged between Thema, and then King Richard would mount his horse and kill as many Saracens as he could, and Saladin would mount his, and kill as many Christians as he could. In this way King Richard fought to his heart at TMS content at Arsuf and at Jaffa, and finding himself with nothing exciting to do at Ascalon, except to rebuild, for his own defense, some fortifications the which the Saracens had destroyed, he kicked his ally the Duke of Austria, for being too proud to work at them. The army at last came within sight of the holy city of Jerusalem, but, being then a nest of jealousy, and quarrelling and fighting, soon retired, and agreed with the Saracens upon a truce for 3 years, 3 months, 3 days, and 3 hours. Then, the English Christians, protected by the noble Saladin from Saracen revenge, visited our savior at EMS tomb, and then King Richard embarked with a small force at Acre to return home. But he was shipwrecked in the Adriatic Sea, and was fain to pass through Germany, under an assumed name. Now, there were many people in Germany who had served in the Holy Land under the proud Duke of Austria who had been kicked, and some of them, easily recognizing a man so remarkable as King Richard, carried their intelligence to the kicked Duke, who straightway took him prisoner at a little inn near Vienna. The Duke here TMS Master the Emperor of Germany, and the King of France, were equally delighted to have so troublesome a monarch in safekeeping. Friendships which are founded on a partnership in doing wrong, are never true, and the King of France was now quite as heartily King Richard a TMS foe, as he had ever been his friend in his unnatural conduct to his father. He monstrously pretended that King Richard had designed to poison him in the East, he charged him with having murdered, there, a man whom he had in truth befriended, he bribed the Emperor of Germany to keep him close prisoner, and, finally, through the plotting of these two princes, Richard was brought before the German legislature, charged with the foregoing crimes, and many others. But he defended himself so well, that many of the assembly were moved to tears by his eloquence and earnestness. It was decided that he should be treated, during the rest of his captivity, in a manner more becoming his dignity than he had been, and that he should be set free on the payment of a heavy ransom. This ransom the English people willingly raised. When Queen Eleanor took it over to Germany, it was at first evaded and refused. But she appealed to the honor of all the princes of the German Empire in behalf of her son, and appealed so well that it was accepted, and the king released. Thereupon, the King of France wrote to Prince John Way, "Take care of thyself. The devil is unchained." ATM, Prince John had reason to fear his brother, for he had been a traitor to him in his captivity. He had secretly joined the French king, had vowed to the English nobles and people that his brother was dead, and had vainly tried to seize the crown. He was now in France, at a place called Evreux. Being the meanest and basest of men, he contrived a mean and base expedient for making himself acceptable to his brother. He invited the French officers of the garrison in that town to dinner, murdered them all, and then took the fortress. With this recommendation to the goodwill of a lion-hearted monarch, he hastened to King Richard, fell on his knees before him, and obtained the intercession of Queen Eleanor. "I forgive him, ATM," said the king, "and I hope I may forget the injury he has done me, as easily as I know he will forget my pardon." ATM, while King Richard was in Sicily, there had been trouble in his dominions at home, one of the bishops whom he had left in charge thereof, arresting the other, and making, in his pride and ambition, as great a show as if he were king himself. But the king hearing of it at Messina, and appointing a new regency, this Longchamp, for that was his name, had fled to France in a woman at EMS dress, and had the been encouraged and supported by the French king. With all these causes of offence against Philip in his mind, King Richard had no sooner been welcomed home by his enthusiastic subjects with great display and splendour, and had no sooner been crowned afresh at Winchester, than he resolved to show the French king that the devil was unchained indeed, and made war against him with great fury. There was fresh trouble at home about this time, arising out of the discontents of the poor people, who complained that they were far more heavily taxed than the rich, and who found a spirited champion in William Fitzosbert, called Longbeard. He became the leader of a secret society, comprising 50,000 men. He was seized by surprise, he stabbed the citizen who first laid hands upon him, and retreated, bravely fighting, to a church, which he maintained 4 days, until he was dislodged by fire, and run through the body as he came out. He was not killed, though, for he was dragged, half dead, at the tail of a horse to Smithfield, and there hanged. Death was long a favorite remedy for silencing the people TMS advocates, but as we go on with this history, I fancy we shall find them difficult to make an end of, for all that. The French war, delayed occasionally by a truce, was still in progress when a certain lord named Vidomer, Viscount of Limoges, chanced to find in his ground a treasure of ancient coins. As the king Otiam's vassal, he sent the king half of it, but the king claimed the whole. The lord refused to yield the whole. The king besieged the lord in his castle, swore that he would take the castle by storm, and hang every man of its defenders on the battlements. There was a strange old song in that part of the country, to the effect that in Limoges an arrow would be made by which King Richard would die. It may be that Bertrand de Gordon, a young man who was one of the defenders of the castle, had often sung it or heard it sung of a winter night, and remembered it when he saw, from his post upon the ramparts, the king attended only by his chief officer riding below the walls surveying the place. He drew an arrow to the head, took steady aim, said between his teeth, "Ay, now I pray God speed thee well, arrow." Atm discharged it, and struck the king in the left shoulder. Although the wound was not at first considered dangerous, it was severe enough to cause the king to retire to his tent, and direct the assault to be made without him. The castle was taken, and every man of its defenders was hanged, as the king had sworn all should be, except Bertrand de Gordon, who was reserved until the royal pleasure respecting him should be known. By that time unskillful treatment had made the wound mortal and the king knew that he was dying. He directed Bertrand to be brought into his tent. The young man was brought there, heavily chained. King Richard looked at him steadily. He looked, as steadily, at the king. "Ay, knave?" "Atm," said King Richard. "Ay, what have I done to thee that thou shouldest take my life?" "Atm, ay, what hast thou done to me?" "Atm," replied the young man. "Ay, with thine own hands thou hast killed my father and my two brothers. Myself thou wouldest have hanged. Let me die now, by any torture that thou wilt. My comfort is, that no torture can save thee. Thou too must die, and, through me, the world is quit of thee." "Atm," again the king looked at the young man steadily. Again the young man looked steadily at him. Perhaps some remembrance of his generous enemy Saladin, who was not a Christian, came into the mind of the dying king. "A youth." "Atm," he said, "ay, I forgive thee. Go unhurt." "Atm," then, turning to the chief officer who had been riding in his company when he received the wound, King Richard said, "Ay, take off his chains, give him 100 shillings, and let him depart." Atm, he sunk down on his couch, and a dark mist seemed in his weakened eyes to fill the tent wherein he had so often rested, and he died. His age was 42. He had reigned 10 years. His last command was not obeyed, for the chief officer flayed Bertrand de Gordon alive, and hanged him. There is an old tune yet known: a sorrowful heir will sometimes outlive many generations of strong men, and even last longer than battle-axes with 20 pounds of steel in the head, by which this king is said to have been discovered in his captivity. Blondel, a favourite minstrel of King Richard, as the story relates, faithfully seeking his royal master, went singing it outside the gloomy walls of many foreign fortresses and prisons, until at last he heard it echoed from within a dungeon, and knew the voice, and cried out in ecstasy, "Ayo, Richard, O my king!" "Atm, you may believe it, if you like. It would be easy to believe worse things." Richard was himself a minstrel and a poet. If he had not been a prince too, he might have been a better man perhaps, and might have gone out of the world with less bloodshed and waste of life to answer for. Chapter XIV: England under King John, called Lackland. At 32 years of age, John became King of England. His pretty little nephew Arthur had the best claim to the throne, but John seized the treasure, and made fine promises to the nobility, and got himself crowned at Westminster within a few weeks after his brother Richard Atm's death. I doubt whether the crown could possibly have been put upon the head of a meaner coward, or a more detestable villain, if England had been searched from end to end to find him out. The French king, Philip, refused to acknowledge the right of John to his new dignity, and declared in favour of Arthur. You must not suppose that he had any generosity of feeling for the fatherless boy. It merely suited his ambitious schemes to oppose the King of England. So John and the French king went to war about Arthur. He was a handsome boy, at that time only 12 years old. He was not born when his father, Geoffrey, had his brains trampled out at the tournament, and, besides the misfortune of never having known a father at EMS guidance and protection, he had the additional misfortune to have a foolish mother, Constance by name, lately married to her third husband. She took Arthur, upon John at EMS accession, to the French king, who pretended to be very much his friend, and who made him a knight, and promised him his daughter in marriage, but, who cared so little about him in reality, that finding it his interest to make peace with King John for a time, he did so without the least consideration for the poor little prince, and heartlessly sacrificed all his interests. Young Arthur, for 2 years afterwards, lived quietly, and in the course of that time his mother died. But, the French king then finding it his interest to quarrel with King John again made Arthur his pretense, and invited the orphan boy to court. "You know your rights, prince, atm," said the French king, "and you would like to be a king. Is it not so?" "Atm, truly, atm," said Prince Arthur, "I should greatly like to be a king." "Atm then, atm," said Philip, "you shall have 200 gentlemen who are knights of mine, and with them you shall go to win back the provinces belonging to you, of which your uncle, the usurping King of England, has taken possession. I myself, meanwhile, will head a force against him in Normandy." Atm. Poor Arthur was so flattered and so grateful that he signed a treaty with the crafty French king, agreeing to consider him his superior lord, and that the French king should keep for himself whatever he could take from King John. Now, King John was so bad in all ways, and King Philip was so perfidious, that Arthur, between the two, might as well have been a lamb between a fox and a wolf. But, being so young, he was ardent and flushed with hope, and, when the people of Brittany, which was his inheritance, sent him 500 more knights and 5,000 foot soldiers, he believed his fortune was made. The people of Brittany had been fond of him from his birth, and had requested that he might be called Arthur, in remembrance of that dimly famous English Arthur, of whom I told you early in this book, whom they believed to have been the brave friend and companion of an old king of their own. They had tales among them about a prophet called Merlin, of the same old time, who had foretold that their own king should be restored to them after hundreds of years, and they believed that the prophecy would be fulfilled in Arthur, that the time would come when he would rule them with a crown of Brittany upon his head, and when neither King of France nor King of England would have any power over them. When Arthur found himself riding in a glittering suit of armor on a richly caparisoned horse, at the head of his train of knights and soldiers, he began to believe this too, and to consider old Merlin a very superior prophet. He did not know how could he, being so innocent and inexperienced, that his little army was a mere nothing against the power of the King of England. The French king knew it, but the poor boy at EMS fate was little to him, so that the King of England was worried and distressed. Therefore, King Philip went his way into Normandy and Prince Arthur went his way towards Mibe, a French town near Poitiers, both very well pleased. Prince Arthur went to attack the town of Mibe, because his grandmother Eleanor, who has so often made her appearance in this history, and who had always been his mother at EMS enemy, was living there, and because his knights said, "Prince, if you can take her prisoner, you will be able to bring the king your uncle to terms." Atm. But she was not to be easily taken. She was old enough by this time, but she was as full of stratagem as she was full of years and wickedness. Receiving intelligence of young Arthur at EMS approach, she shut herself up in a high tower, and encouraged her soldiers to defend it like men. Prince Arthur with his little army besieged the high tower. King John, hearing how matters stood, came up to the rescue, with his army. So here was a strange family party. The boy prince besieging his grandmother, and his uncle besieging him. This position of affairs did not last long. One summer night King John, by treachery, got his men into the town, surprised Prince Arthur at EMS force, took 200 of his knights, and seized the prince himself in his bed. The knights were put in heavy irons, and driven away in open carts drawn by bullocks, to various dungeons where they were most inhumanly treated, and where some of them were starved to death. Prince Arthur was sent to the castle of Falaise. One day, while he was in prison at that castle, mournfully thinking it strange that one so young should be in so much trouble, and looking out of the small window in the deep dark wall, at the summer sky and the birds, the door was softly opened, and he saw his uncle the king standing in the shadow of the archway, looking very grim. "Eh, Arthur, atm," said the king, with his wicked eyes more on the stone floor than on his nephew, "eh, will you not trust to the gentleness, the friendship, and the truthfulness of your loving uncle?" "Atm, eh, I will tell my loving uncle that, atm," replied the boy, "eh, when he does me right. Let him restore to me my kingdom of England, and then come to me and ask the question." "Atm." The king looked at him and went out. "Eh, keep that boy close prisoner, atm," said he to the warden of the castle. Then, the king took secret counsel with the worst of his nobles how the prince was to be got rid of. Some said, "Eh, put out his eyes and keep him in prison, as Robert of Normandy was kept." "Atm." Others said, "A, have him stabbed." "Atm." Others, "A, have him hanged." "Atm." Others, "A, have him poisoned." "Atm." King John, feeling that in any case, whatever was done afterwards, it would be a satisfaction to his mind to have those handsome eyes burnt out that had looked at him so proudly while his own royal eyes were blinking at the stone floor, sent certain ruffians to Falaise to blind the boy with red-hot irons. But Arthur so pathetically entreated them, and shed such piteous tears, and so appealed to Hubert de Burgh, or Burgh, the warden of the castle, who had a love for him, and was an honourable, tender man, that Hubert could not bear it. To his eternal honour he prevented the torture from being performed, and, at his own risk, sent the savages away. The chafed and disappointed king bethought himself of the stabbing suggestion next, and, with his shuffling manner and his cruel face, proposed it to one William de Bray. "Eh, I am a gentleman and not an executioner, atm," said William de Bray, and left the presence with disdain. But it was not difficult for a king to hire a murderer in those days. King John found one for his money, and sent him down to the castle of Falaise. "Eh, on what errand dost thou come?" "Atm," said Hubert to this fellow. "Eh, to dispatch young Arthur, atm," he returned. "Eh, go back to him who sent thee, atm," answered Hubert, "eh, and say that I will do it." "Atm." King John, very well knowing that Hubert would never do it, but that he courageously sent this reply to save the prince or gain time, dispatched messengers to convey the young prisoner to the castle of Rouen. Arthur was soon forced from the good Hubert, of whom he had never stood in greater need than the carried away by night, and lodged in his new prison, where, through his grated window, he could hear the deep waters of the River Seine, rippling against the stone wall below. One dark night, as he lay sleeping, dreaming perhaps of rescue by those unfortunate gentlemen who were obscurely suffering and dying in his cause, he was roused, and bidden by his jailer to come down the staircase to the foot of the tower. He hurriedly dressed himself and obeyed. When they came to the bottom of the winding stairs, and the night air from the river blew upon their faces, the jailer trod upon his torch and put it out. Then, Arthur, in the darkness, was hurriedly drawn into a solitary boat. And in that boat, he found his uncle and one other man. He knelt to them, and prayed them not to murder him. Deaf to his entreaties, they stabbed him and sunk his body in the river with heavy stones. When the spring morning broke, the tower door was closed, the boat was gone. The river sparkled on its way, and nevermore was any trace of the poor boy beheld by mortal eyes. The news of this atrocious murder being spread in England, awakened a hatred of the king, already odious for his many vices, and for his having stolen away and married a noble lady while his own wife was living, that never slept again through his whole reign. In Brittany, the indignation was intense. Athuretiam's own sister Eleanor was in the power of John and shut up in a convent at Bristol, but his half-sister Alice was in Brittany. The people chose her, and the murdered Prince Athuretiam's father-in-law, the last husband of Constance, to represent them, and carried their fiery complaints to King Philip. King Philip summoned King John, as the holder of territory in France, to come before him and defend himself. King John refusing to appear, King Philip declared him false, perjured, and guilty, and again made war. In a little time, by conquering the greater part of his French territory, King Philip deprived him of one-third of his dominions.